This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
Hi, everyone. My name is Georgia Sui. I'm a second-year MBA student and a teaching assistant for Stephanie Creery's course, Leading Diversity in Organizations. I'm excited to welcome you today to the Leading Diversity at Wharton speaker series. Our moderator, Professor Stephanie Creery, is an assistant professor of management here at the Wharton School. Professor Creery is an identity and diversity scholar, and her research focuses on the identity and diversity work that individuals and leaders engage in to improve the quality of relationships across differences at work. As many of you know, Professor Creery teaches a course, Leading Diversity in Organizations, to Wharton undergraduate and MBA students, and is the creator of the Leading Diversity at Wharton speaker series. Today, she will be engaging in a discussion about race, diversity, inclusion, and belonging in the workplace with several special guests. Our first guest is Dr. Laura Morgan Roberts, who is a professor of practice at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business and a visiting scholar at Harvard Business School's Gender Initiative. A thought leader in diversity, inclusion, authenticity, and identity development, Laura is the co-editor of Race, Work, and Leadership, Positive Organizing in a Global Society, in addition to two other books, and she is the author of numerous research articles, teaching cases, and practitioner-oriented tools. Our second guest is Allison Maitland, who is a writer, speaker, advisor, and coach. Specializing in leadership, inclusion, and the changing world of work, Allison has co-authored two previous books, in addition to Indivisible. A former long-serving journalist with the Financial Times, she is a senior fellow in human capital at the Conference Board and senior visiting fellow at the Business School, formerly CAS, London, and chair of the school's Global Women's Leadership Program Executive Board. And finally, our third guest is Rebecca Steele, who is a business strategist, innovator, and speaker with deep expertise in diversity inclusion, as well as the co-author of Indivisible. Building on two decades in the corporate world, including as a senior leader in Fortune 500 companies, Rebecca launched her consultancy focused on the intersection of diversity, inclusion, and human-centered design thinking. She's also a senior fellow and council director with the Conference Board. Laura, Allison, Rebecca, thank you all so much for joining us today. Stephanie, without further ado, I will pass it over to you.
Thank you so much, Georgia. Appreciate all of your work and for that beautiful introduction. And thank you all for being here. Also, thank you to Laura, Allison, and Rebecca for joining us. I'm sure this is going to be a really enlightening experience for us all and certainly fun for me. I actually have known each of our guests today for a long time. I won't say how long that I've known you, but in a professional space, I used to work at the Conference Board. And Laura's been my longtime collaborator on a lot of research and other endeavors. So for me, this is like friends having a conversation today and introducing my friends to students and to other professionals who are really interested in knowing more about your scholarship and your work and how that can enhance what it is that they're working on. And so talking about your various approaches in your work to inclusive leadership during these current times, I'm sure it will make for a great conversation today. So just a quick note for the audience before I dive into the specific questions that I have. We're going to be taking questions from the audience later. So please enter your questions in the Q&A window throughout our conversation. I'll monitor those questions, and as we have time, I will ask those that I feel will certainly enhance our conversation beyond those that the conversation we've been having. So I want to start by introducing you, our guests, and your books to our audience. Allison and Rebecca, you co-wrote Indivisible, and Laura, you edited and contributed several chapters, might I add, to Race, Work, and Leadership. I'd love to hear more about what motivated you to engage in this work, to create these books, to edit the books. Let's start with Laura.
Thank you, Stephanie. I was inspired to help curate the Race, Work, and Leadership edited volume as a component of a broader initiative at Harvard Business School, which involved commemorating the 50th anniversary of the founding of HBS's African American Student Union. Now, ASU 50 took place in 2018, and that was 50 years post not just the founding of ASU, but also a host of other social changes around racial justice and civil rights in our country. So it felt important and timely for us to take stock from a research and practice standpoint of how far we come with respect to race, work, and leadership. So we sought thought leaders who have been asking these questions about race, work, and leadership for many, many years, and invited them to contribute some deep insights, evidence-based critiques, and recommendations for action. And we had over 50 contributors in this edited volume. There are over 30 chapters, and they provide a very rich analysis of the current state of affairs with respect to the Black experience in particular, but also the implications for how we've been engaging in work around diversity and inclusion in our organization. So each of the chapters are really rich enough to stand on their own, which was another exciting piece of this edited volume. But there are also some themes that we can talk about during our time together.
Absolutely. I just want to read a very short passage, Laura, from the foreword of this book. And the foreword is called Race in Organizations, Often Cloaked but Always Present. And it's written by two scholars who I admire as humans, but certainly for their scholarship, Ella Edmondson Bell and Stello Incomo, who were doing scholarship on race in academia long, long, long before it was even slightly okay to be talking about this subject matter. And so they make several important points in this foreword. One is that, you know, we've always struggled as an academic field to understand what the place is of race in a conversation about work. But they say why it's important. And they said racism makes race matter. Currently, race and racism are being uncloaked in virulent expressions of white supremacy nationally and globally. And they talk about this being the reawakening of a belligerent nationalism with deep historical roots. They reference the Charlottesville March, led by the alt-right in 2017, has been described as a coming out event for those who wish to see a return to the days of the Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow laws. So overt have been the expressions of racism and racial harassment that African Americans have had to plead Black Lives Matter, endure an increasing number of incidents of white people calling out the police about white people calling the police about African Americans engaging in everyday activities, and tolerate being feared by whites as troublemakers and criminals. And so they talk about these phenomena aren't new, and it's certainly not new as we think about the events of this summer, the murder of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery. But I just want to remind our audience, this book was written before then. And so your motivation to, I think, engage in the scholarship, and certainly Stella and Ella's words, predate what we refer to as 2020. Can you just say a little bit more about that before I turn over to Allison and Rebecca for their thoughts?
That's right. One of the points that always resonates with me from that foreword is the way in which Stella and Ella remind us that despite the best effort, even by some DEI practitioners, from people on the alt-right, from people who consider themselves to be well-meaning, or, you know, directly undermining these efforts, there's just been a widespread attempt to erase race from the conversation. And it says, despite all of these different attempts to minimize, cloak, disappear, not touch, keep race over in the corner as this taboo topic, it still endures because racism still endures. And so in the context of 2020, I think that's a conversation we've been having, and we've had to confront it. We've seen it, you know, in plain sight. We saw it on the street with George Floyd's murder. We saw it in homes with Breonna Taylor's murder. And we saw it in Central Park with Amy Cooper. And as a result, people have started to speak much more candidly about their own experiences, and they're naming it so that we can acknowledge it and really start to engage in this work of racial justice and inclusion in 2020 in ways that we hadn't before, you know, including in 2019 when our book came out.
Absolutely. So Allison and Rebecca, your book also predates 2020 and is also timeless and timely. and it's focused on this idea of inclusion in organizations. Would love to hear a bit more about your motivation for, first of all, for collaborating with one another. I think it's always great when you have collaborators here to talk about why they decided to work together. But this particular topic, what was your motivation for actually writing a book about inclusion in organizations? So I'm gonna just point to Allison, and you all can go back and forth between the two of you in terms of who wants to say more.
Great, well, actually, thank you. Thank you for having us. And I'll just say something briefly about our collaboration, because you've asked about that. One of the interesting things about our collaboration is that Rebecca's in Canada and I'm in the UK. So we wrote this book pretty much entirely, virtually, as it were, with virtual collaboration, through virtual collaboration. And that in itself was, for me, a great learning experience in terms of inclusion and how actually, you know, how important that is in this new world of work. We'll perhaps come to that later. But Rebecca, why don't you jump in on sort of what motivated us really to do this work together?
Certainly. And thanks so much, Stephanie and Laura, for kicking off such a compelling conversation with your insight so far. And for, you know, asking us, Stephanie, about the collaboration, which has been a joy. And you know, I think in our work with organizations across an array of industries around the world, Allison and I both saw a persistent gap, and that was that leaders are very engaged with the concept that inclusion is beneficial, but they really struggle to bring inclusion's value to life. And we find that that's because they don't know exactly what inclusion is. They don't know how to advance it and how to sustain it. And they don't know how to measure inclusion itself, but also its impacts on organizational success, on business outcomes, and on healthy societies. And so we knew that organizations could do better, really a whole lot better. And so that's why we set out to close this gap between the promise and practice of inclusion. And we wanted to do that with research evidence, case examples, a strategic framework, but also with some specific actions for individuals and organizations to take a whole new approach to inclusion so that they can actually achieve more successful, more sustainable results for organizations and for society. Allison, can you add to that?
Well, I think I'd just add maybe a little bit about why we were motivated to focus the book on inclusion. It's not because we think that diversity is done. I mean, absolutely, you know, far from it. But it's because, you know, without inclusion, diversity remains unfulfilled potential. And we see, you know, D&I are complementary, DE&I are complementary, but D&I are different from each other. They're actually, you know, they're often confused. I mean, how often have you been having conversations with people where they move from the word diversity to the word inclusion in the same breath, meaning talking about the same thing, but they're not the same thing. And we felt that, you know, inclusion was really the poor relation and needed much greater explanation and needed much greater understanding. So inclusion is really about creating and sustaining, you know, a whole environment where the full mix of people, identities, ideas, backgrounds, experiences, perspectives can truly flourish, you know, can truly thrive and contribute their best to the organization. And we call it, in the book, we call it harnessing our collective superpower. So inclusion is harnessing the collective superpower of diversity. And we were driven to do this because we knew the potential of this collective superpower. It's enormous, as we show in the book. You know, we talk about inclusion in terms of not just, you know, the positive impact that it has on well-being and lived experiences, which is so important, but also creating business value. And we talk about these three P's of performance. We know so much about, we pull it all together, but so much about how inclusion contributes to smarter decision-making, to innovation, you know, to customer relations, to bottom line results, but also these other two P's. So the three P's, performance, preparedness, and purpose. And preparedness is about preparing people in organizations for the new world of work, for indeed for a world of work in which we're working alongside smart machines, for example. And the purpose is critical too, because organizations are under such pressure now to demonstrate that they have a purpose out there, and advancing inclusion across society is a really good way to do that. So, you know, business leaders are really paying close attention to all these things.
Absolutely. And speaking of harnessing our collective superpower, I have my book, Indivisible, open to that very chapter. And I just wanted to read a passage that struck me as being especially important as I'm thinking about, you know, we continue to have these conversations, whether it's about race, work, and leadership or inclusion all the time. And we're constantly trying to figure out why haven't we made as much progress. And I think in both of your books, you give us reasons for that. Here's one that I hone in on in your introductory chapter that I think is really important that we should think about. Many organizations look to human resources and communications to lead their inclusion efforts. We go beyond this to address functions from research and design through operations to marketing and sales. We take into account external relations with suppliers, investors, and governments. There is also crucial learning for students of business, leadership, and organizational design. Whatever your role at your organization, we invite you to dive in. So let's dive in a bit more into this conversation. I have a question for Laura, specifically as it relates to this notion of meritocracy. This is a topic that we've talked about quite extensively in my course at Wharton. It's something that I spend a lot of time talking to about in my research with Laura, and certainly to organizational leaders. So Laura is not surprised that we're going to talk about meritocracy today. So Laura, you do a lot of work on race, diversity, positive identities, best self. When you think about some of the opportunities and challenges, and the promise of a meritocracy, I want to get your perspective on whether you feel like that's actually possible. Is it possible for an organization to be meritocratic? And if so, what do you think, based on, you know, your own research or other evidence, are some of the things that we should be considering if we're really trying to aspire for our organizations to be meritocratic? So big question, but certainly I know something a lot about.
Yeah, no, big question, big aspiration, right? The shared aspiration, I think, depending on who you're asking, they might define it differently, and that's where it gets a little bit more complicated. So let's say on the surface, when we think about a meritocracy, we're thinking about a system that is just and equitable. Now, when we're talking about a system that's just, we're talking about people, all people, getting what they deserve or getting what they've earned. And then the equitable piece is calibrating for obstructions and advantages that would then make it fair at the end of the day. So now, we engage in some mind tricks, okay? So we've got some psychological barriers that make this meritocratic aspiration a bit challenging for us to actualize or to make real. Our mind tricks around inputs and mind tricks about outputs. So here's one mind trick: effort. Who defines a hard day's work? How do we define a hard day's work? Why is it that people who are low-wage laborers may work longer hours but get paid less money? How are we constructing from a power and status lens the input that would justify a reward? Okay, that's one question that we have to grapple with. We then layer into that not just the sweat equity, but then people also talk about their real investments, like their financial investments. So we're talking to a lot of Stephanie's students, Professor Creary, so I'll call you Professor Creary as we're using that particular lens and model when we come into our classes, we know that our students are financially investing in building their human capital. They're getting some cultural capital and some pedigree along the way. They may be also living in communities where they're paying certain tax dollars. So you're expecting that you're going to be able to get other kinds of benefits due to the investment that you put in. But what of the individuals who don't have those same kinds of options and opportunities available to them? This is where part of that meritocratic ideal falls apart. This is part of what we found in our research. We found that Black professionals in particular, they lack access to opportunities that would allow them to grow and develop in their careers, to build human capital, to accrue wealth or build financial capital. They lack the experiences of authenticity and inclusion in their organizations or workplaces, or even in their schools where they feel they can go and bring their whole selves and fully leverage the strengths that they have, you know, draw upon those superpowers of their diversity. So that's a challenge for them. And then we also found in our research that even when they're successful, and this is the meritocratic piece, it would say if you're successful, then you should get the reward. Same as everybody else, right? It's not actually what we find in our research. We find that people who are members of the dominant group are rewarded a bit with more benefits or more perks when they succeed, and they're penalized less heavily when they fail. But the opposite is true for Black professionals and other members of marginalized groups. They suffer heavier penalties for a real or a construed or suspected failure. So this unqualified view of meritocracy, it's challenging because it actually perpetuates the injustice that we say we're trying to fight against. It creates a false narrative that says everybody has the same opportunity or the same chance to put in, and that when everybody puts in, everybody's getting the same thing out of it. And the research, you know, compels that it isn't. Emilio Castillo's work at MIT, for instance, shows that for organizations that are deeply invested in this meritocratic ideal, they believe that this is how their system works, simple, fair and square, inputs to outputs, they're the most likely to perpetuate some of the forms of injustice that we're trying to fight against. So we have to really confront the complexity and the obstructions that come in that, if nothing else, create mind tricks, but also can create institutional barriers around making this work lead to the outcomes that we desire. I think the last piece I wanted to say about meritocracy reminded me, Stephanie, of your piece, so I just had to throw it in there while we were on the topic, that many of the dynamics that we're just calling out, they also then keep us from rewarding the people who are doing the hard work of calling out the inequities in the system that exists. They don't often get the same merit-based rewards for the contributions that they're making to our organizations and our society. So I guess that all comes down on a somewhat skeptical view of whether or not I was a meritocracy that does not calibrate for these social inequalities and these mind tricks is a bit more of a fantasy, and it's a damaging fantasy. But if we can pursue this principle of meritocracy in a way that does account for the injustices and our own little, you know, mind tricks, we would be on the right path to promoting greater inclusion.
Thank you so much, Laura. I want to sort of make this conversation even more complicated by talking about the very real tension that exists, I think, for my students and many of us who do this work, and many of us who do this work in organizations. And that is the tension behind our passions around advocating for diversity, equity, and inclusion, because we feel like it's the right thing to do, it's just, and it's the equitable thing to do, and this need to make the business case for D&I. And I feel that Allison and Rebecca have certainly had to do this quite extensively in their own work. And so let me start with Rebecca, if I may. I would love to get a little bit of your perspective on first this tension, what it is, how it manifests, and what have you seen are effective, either personally or more organizationally? What are some effective methods for helping to, I think, navigate this tension and to get positive outcomes? Let's just leave it there. So, Rebecca, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly see this dynamic at play and shifting a bit over time, so that more recently, we've seen a shift towards more leaders of organizations saying, wait a minute, there is a moral case. Do we really need a business case for inclusion? Whereas in a few years prior, we really spent a lot of time trying to prove and reprove the business case so that leaders would get on board and actually take action that could get results. So we do find in our work that, you know, even when there is a really strong commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion as the moral obligation or the right thing to do, it's great to see that more and more. But we do still see that unless we treat inclusion like any other business driver, such as marketing or research and development or finance or whatever, unless we treat inclusion with the same rigor, you know, having a strategy, having leadership, expertise, resources, metrics, accountability, and so on. Without that business case, it still gets treated like a distraction sometimes from what's really important to the business, or sometimes it gets treated sort of as an addition that's nice to have if we find time for it on top of what we're really here to do. But the moral case or the right thing to do case doesn't keep it centered as vitally important. And then what we see is progress is just so sorely limited. So in our book, we show how to treat inclusion like the business driver it is. Allison, what would you add to that?
Yes, I mean, well, we know that, you know, it is both the right thing and the smart thing to do. We know that. And when it comes to getting people on board, you know, what are the most effective ways to get people on board for change? I think we have to take a combination of approaches because people are very differently motivated for this. And so one of the things I would add is that we do need to address hearts as well as minds to get people on board. And by hearts, I mean, you know, really connecting with people around our common humanity and how inclusion benefits each and every one of us, as well as talking about the business impact, which, as Rebecca says quite rightly, you know, if you're really going to make sustained change, you need it to be tied directly into business priorities and goals. I find this human connection, that side of it, you know, and overcoming our discomfort with difference is a really important topic when I'm coaching leaders and emerging leaders. So I think, you know, we have to be adaptable. We have to try lots of different approaches, not say it's this or this. It's all of those.
So Laura, I want to give you a chance to add your additional thoughts here, but two things came up for me as I was listening to Rebecca and Allison talk. One, your piece in Bloomberg around justice and needing to bring that back in, and certainly your piece in HBR that sort of kicked off a series of articles focused on what racial justice means. I also thought, because sort of I'm intimately familiar with a lot of your work, you've taken this idea of head, heart, hands that has been, I think, utilized in so many different capacities in human capital and talent management and made it your own with this idea of helping people to see these are complementary, I guess I would say, approaches to thinking about the topic. So I just gave you a whole bunch of possibilities here that you can add to our discussion, but certainly feel free to share what you would like to in response to what Rebecca and Allison shared.
You know, I just had a great conversation last night about this as well with my executive MBA students at Darden as we wrapped up our course on diversity. And what we have really been exploring in that course is the complementarity, the synergy, as well as the tension between the two. And so we started to think about this Venn diagram that would say, well, where's the overlap between the business case and the moral case? And, you know, what happens when you have the business case absent the moral case or vice versa? So if you're driving on a business case for diversity, then you're focusing a lot on representation. If you're not taking moral considerations into into account, if there's no justice narrative around that, you have exploitation. You have the same forms of Black exploitation that have driven oppression and inequality in various forms for centuries. So there's also, you know, in 2020, a new twist on that, which is you can find a business case for doing some virtue signaling or like showing up, perhaps doing a little cultural appropriation, you know, putting that square on the Black Lives Matter Instagram, you know, signaling to just showcase in some public ways for the sake of consumer appeal or appeasing other stakeholders that, you know, hey, we're in the mix too, but we're not really doing the work. That's another way of being kind of instrumental. What happens on the other side if you've got the moral case that's driving, but you're not bringing in the business implications of it, you know, and really like engaging the two? You may not be doing harm. You may just be stagnated, right? Just continue to remind people about justice and the right things to do, but not actually gaining traction in using a multi-stakeholder approach. But you could take it to an extreme. You could do some harm there too if you start to engage in saviorism. And we see that happen with members of dominant groups trying to say, well, yes, look what I did to help this person or that person. Ultimately, like, what do we want to happen at this synergy? You know, this is what Stephanie and I, what we've written about. You know, we've talked about resource generation that's happening at that synergy when we truly engage and value the differences. You know, because you can exploit resources, you can suppress resources by not looking at them at all. But if you really want to generate resources and create a more vibrant and sustainable society, you've got to operate at the synergy or the overlap between the two. The way that I get at that more practically in my coaching and advising is to have conversations about values alignment. So what is a business justification for doing the right thing in any respect for a corporation? It's identity logic. We do this because this is who we are. You know, this is what we stand for. We build, we generate, we have a positive impact. This just defines who we are as an institution. Or you can say this is a part of our culture. This is how we do what we do to generate business results. And our culture is one of inclusive processes and practices. But at the bottom, at the end of the day, we're learning how to truly value and respect the differences. And as much as we value and respect our similarities, and then we're trying to make sure that we're, you know, maintaining a healthy sense of mutuality where one group is not overpowering the other.
So if I had to put a face and a title to any singular group of people in organizations that in my research and my work, I've seen struggle perhaps the most and continue to struggle with their place in this conversation and how to navigate these and other tensions, that would be middle managers in organizations. And certainly, Rebecca and Allison, in your introduction, you say that your book is intended for lots of audiences, but including this audience. We know, you know, from your work and from mine, from Laura's work, is that it does take a lot to convince senior leaders to get on board. But for senior leaders, creating the strategy and saying we're going to do this is oftentimes where the job ends. With respect to diversity, equity, inclusion. It is up to people who are direct supervisors to implement all of this work, to try to figure out what does it mean to be inclusive? What does it mean to be anti-racist? How do I create justice? And what we know from research, both in academia and both in practice, is that middle managers don't often feel efficacious. They don't feel like they often have the tools to do these big, grand deals that we are charging them with when we say, okay, we're gonna be a inclusive, just, and, you know, equitable organization. So let me shoot this question to Allison. We talk about middle managers a lot in my classes. I have MBA classes and I have undergraduate classes. And for the undergrads, it's about who your direct supervisor is probably gonna be a middle manager when you graduate. And for my MBA students, there many of them have been middle managers or they will be middle managers when they leave Wharton. So I want to talk about one approach that you all have in your book. It's called the impact approach. And I'm interested in having you share some of the key actions for this group of middle managers that you think that they should be taking to actually build this more inclusive workplace that you're addressing in the context of your work.
Sure, great. Well, Stephanie, maybe I could just start by briefly describing, you know, what our whole system approach, because we do take this whole system approach, and then maybe Rebecca can, talk about the sort of specifics about middle managers, because it's kind of in that bigger context. So I mean, our starting point for this really is that if you're going to achieve all of the impact that inclusion promises, you know, inclusion has to be more than it is at the moment in most organizations, more than, you know, a series of disjointed or disconnected initiatives, more than a few questions that are inserted into an employee engagement survey that ask people about, you know, whether they feel that they're truly valued, truly respected, and so on, whether they feel that they belong. It's got to be about more than single identity groups, affinity groups, or focusing only on marginalized groups. And it also has to be more than an end in itself. And we've talked about that already. So we set out this really comprehensive whole system approach. We take a systems thinking lens to this. We show how we show organizations actually and leaders, you know, the full extent of inclusion, the depth and breadth of inclusion. And we do that by identifying 10 inclusion enablers that we call them. And these are things that really create connection, opportunity, and common cause in organizations. Things like openness, respect, fairness, transparency, and things like shared power, which is less talked about, distributed power. And you know, we show how inclusion impacts everyone, how everyone has a role to play, everyone is responsible, which of course takes you into middle managers. We show how organizations have to address, you know, in every part of their operations, inclusion in every part of their operations, and how processes are absolutely crucial to support and guide inclusive behavior, because so many organizations just focus on the inclusive behavior or only on the processes, but not sort of actually consistently across all of them. You've already mentioned about how we focus on external stakeholders as well as internal. And we demonstrate, you know, different ways of measuring, new ways of measuring with new scorecards. And then we have all of these actions which we set out for people at every level of the organization, for senior leaders, for middle managers, and for individual contributors, because everybody has a role to play. So Rebecca, I'm sure will you know, share more about the actual actions and how to get middle managers on board.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that setup about putting it in the context of the whole system, which is a really critical part of what we're sharing in our book. You know, middle managers, like you said, Stephanie, are so often described as sort of stuck, or they're left out of the equation of helping to enable diversity, equity, and inclusion, or even let off the hook for making really meaningful changes. But of course, this doesn't work out well for DE&I results, because they're really vitally important contributors, because they're really at the sharp end of implementing strategy and, as you said, directly influencing and impacting workers. So that means we have to help middle managers succeed and, of course, hold them accountable for inclusion results, not just actions, but results. And when we do that, when we provide that kind of support, we really can unleash a very potent force for inclusion right at the heart of the organization. So in the book, we outline how to do that. We show parallels with how we engage middle managers with other business imperatives to show how organizations can engage middle managers by making sure that they understand that inclusion is an explicit priority, and that they can benefit. But so can their teams, and so can the business and business stakeholders as a whole. We also talk about how we need to make sure they're really clear on what they're expected to do to advance inclusion, that they have a role to play, and that they also know what to do to meet those expectations, and that we're supporting them in that. Organizations also need to ensure that middle managers have the skills, the capabilities, and of course the resources to succeed. And they have to be really well supported, not only by their senior leaders, but also by formal processes, like Allison talked about in the whole system approach. And of course, they need to be held accountable, again, for results through things like regular reviews that can be reinforced with recognition and reward when they're successful, or, you know, opportunities for coaching or development when they're not quite meeting the mark, or even appropriate sanctions when they fall short. So it's really not that different from how we help middle managers succeed in everything that they're responsible for. It's just we haven't put the rigor around it for this particular piece of work.
Absolutely. Laura, I was thinking about, you know, the work that you've done looking at relationships in organizations, lots of different relationships, hierarchical relationships that differ based on the power and status of those who are in the relationship itself, whether we're talking about mentoring relationships, whether we're talking about supervisor, subordinate, or direct report relationships. And so I'm interested in hearing your perspective as we begin to think about the complexities, particularly around race, which is what your book is about, key insights that you have around these key role relationships, whether it's middle managers and direct support, direct reports, or whether it's really just having, you know, two people who differ racially trying to support one another. What are some of the insights from your work that you think is pertinent to helping to develop our capacities to create more inclusive environments?
Yeah, I think what's really important for us to recognize is just the level of inexposure and uncertainty that breeds anxiety when people are trying to build relationships across difference. There's some wonderful research by Nicole Shelton that talks about the fact that people have different goals in cross-race interactions, for instance. That when white people in her experimental studies come in seeking to be liked in these interracial interactions, but their black counterparts come in seeking to be respected in their interracial interactions. And so when you have these goals for the kind of impression that you're trying to create for the other person, then you're also going to engage in a different set of behaviors. So this plays out in the research that we are able to uncover when we talk to people who are feeling plateaued in their careers and wondering why they're not getting the same kind of mentoring, sponsorship, developmental feedback from their superiors. We have, you know, Black women who are mid-career and they're wondering why they don't seem to be on the radar as, you know, someone who's a high potential, because their strategy has been, I'm going to prove myself through my work. I'm going to show you how capable I am. You're going to respect me. And that's my strategy. And I'm going to keep my head down. I'm not going to play politics. I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to, you know, use small talk. I don't feel safe disclosing parts of my intersectional identities. If I show you how enthusiastic I am about something, it might trigger a negative stereotype that you have about Black women, for instance. And so I'm just going to kind of keep it professional. I'm going to keep it behind the veil and just focus on the work. Make it about the work. Well, how do you think that's experienced by their counterparts? The white counterparts are thinking, like, this person doesn't want to make a connection with me. They don't like me. They're not smiling at me enough. They're not giving me that affirmation and validation. Why don't they ever come out for drinks? Why do they always leave right after the meeting and go straight back to their office? And they're thinking, I've got to get back to get off these three emails. So there's a disconnect, okay? So the wires are crossing there. And I think that's one of the most important things that we need to unpack make a shared commitment for appreciating where the other person is coming from, what their goals and aspirations might be in the relationship, and also what their hopes and fears might be in the relationship. The other dynamic that we have to be aware of is the one that's called homophily, which is just like attracts like. So people in high power positions tend to bet on the potential of people who remind them of their younger selves, right? So if I have a limited amount of dollars or resources or political capital, and I have to make a bet on where I'm going to get the biggest payoff, I look at myself, I say, well, I'm pretty successful. So I'll go ahead and bet on somebody else's potential who looks like me, because I think they're going to be successful too. That's going to pay off. What about Laura? Ooh, I don't know. Can't really relate to Laura. There are a lot of things about Laura that I just don't really reflect my cultural context, my reality, my background. We don't have the same jokes. We don't wear the same clothes. We don't work out in the same places. There's lots of dimensions of difference that create barriers. You know, over time, what happens is that people who, back to the meritocracy conversation, the paradox, that people who are investing so much and working really, really hard and trying to prove themselves and build their skills and capabilities, A, they're not getting the feedback they need, B, they're not building the relationships and the trust they need, and C, even if they're doing the first two things, they aren't having the same experiences of sponsors, you know, putting forth their name when they're not in their room and betting on their potential. So we use our research to just lay this out. You know, we in multiple sectors and multiple industries, we talk about healthcare, we talk about education, we talk about law, we talk about financial services, we talk about community justice and activism. We talk about religious institutions, how these dynamics are playing out across sectors. We all see what's happening, then we can act with greater intention to build more authentic connections with one another, and to do that encourage because it requires both people to step out of their comfort zone and take a risk.
And you even talk about this, there's actually a chapter in there that's about academia as well. I appreciated that chapter in the book, that sometimes I know as an academic, we recuse ourselves from believing that we're in the world and we're contributing to these issues, whereas, you know, we're a workplace. I have a job, right? I get paid to be here and to work with other people. We are not immune from these dynamics. I think that anybody here today is setting out. I was just talking to a student earlier about these types of dynamics and how they show up in student clubs, right? I'm forever getting students who want to meet with me to talk about in their little mini organizations, how we see all these dynamics that we talk about here today in the class playing out. Allison, I think you wanted to share something with us.
Yeah, I mean, what Laura was saying was just fabulous. I mean, unpicking all of those layers, and it just made me think about how useful an inclusive process, having a team agreement or rules of engagement at the start of any project is. Whether it's, you know, it could be in a one-to-one relationship, but equally in a team that's starting out, and then renewing that team agreement. And in that team agreement, getting everybody to contribute, so really everybody has a say. What do they need from the environment in order to be their best? What do they need from themselves in order to be the best best that they can be, in order to contribute the best? And then you start to sort of get out into the open a whole load of things that otherwise just remain under the surface for years and years and years, as you're talking about, Laura. So it's a fantastic way to just to lay the groundwork and have everybody contributing, and then everybody saying, okay, so can we all sign up to these things? Is this how we're going to treat each other? And then you can come back to the team agreement, you can renew it, you know, a month down the line, or you know, in a year's time, or whatever it is. It's like a living document, a living document that's part of your relationship. And you can do the same, I guess, in a one-to-one.
Yeah, I love those strategies. I think about when we come together every quarter that I teach this class, we develop, it's not really a contract, but a set of norms that the students say that they want to agree to for the course of the quarter so that we can have some productive, effective conversations. And I know it always feels a little bit kitschy to do it, but it goes without saying, people need to know what the expectations are. And they need to have an understanding that I can say that I thought we were agreed to do this and we're not doing that. So can we talk about why it's not happening? It's so important when you have people who have different perspectives and different backgrounds and are coming from different places working together. I want to also introduce into our conversation this concept called allyship. And certainly it means a lot of things to a lot of people. I certainly use it in my own work, which is not necessarily the way that everybody else uses it in their own work. But as we talk about race, diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's one of the solutions that people often put out there. There's lots of allyship trainings now. There's about, you know, can you call yourself an ally? Or do I have to call you an ally? So there's a lot of conversation right now about allyship. But I want to introduce that to our conversation as we're thinking about solutions. What are some of the, I think, the opportunities and the challenges with respect to effective allyship? I'm going to go to Laura first because one, you already said, and I just want to give voice to it again. It was about this idea of a savior. Introducing, I've heard some white people say, I'm afraid that's going to come across as that I'm trying to save, you know, XYZ person who's not of my same race or gender if I help, right? So it's like, I'm afraid that people are going to accuse me of being a savior, so I'm going to be reticent to help. I've also heard Black and brown people and females and people who are in the marginalized groups say, I feel like that person is trying to save. And to me, that's like, no, don't do that. So I wanted to give you the chance to sort of elaborate this sort of savior conversation dynamic in the context of allyship, but also, Laura, feel free to share your own perspective on what allyship, great allyship, should look like.
Yeah, that's great, Stephanie, because there's also another voice in there, which is what really makes people confused. It's when you also have Black and brown people who were saying, I'm tired of doing all the work, it's your turn. So then they're like, well, wait a minute. Now, I'm not trying to save. I don't want to be a savior, but you're also saying like, I'm tired. You pick it up. You pick the ball. What is it? So Sarah Kaplan and I wrote a Bloomberg piece earlier this year, and we talked about allyship involving three steps. So, you know, one is just step up. And I think this is aligned with Stephanie, your work on LEAP. It's just, you know, lean into it. The answer is not to deny, defend, disengage. Like, oh, I'm scared people might think I'm doing too much, so I won't do anything. No, that's not, that's like if your kid tried that one on you, like, you know, go take out the trash. Oh, I don't want to go overboard on that. I'll just not do my chores. No, that would never fly. So the same step up, right? Stay in it, stay with the discomfort. I am coaching senior executives who are worried about this saviorism piece, and they say, I just don't know exactly what I should do. I said, oh, so you are trying to make sense of your sense of place, try to understand your sense of place as a white male, as the institution is doing this important work. Yeah, that's it. I said, welcome to the club. This is exactly what all your counterparts are saying. They've been trying to make sense of who they are with their intersectional identities as we do the important work of the organization. So you're not alone in that. We're all in it together. Step up. But then there are other two important points. At critical juncture, you know, when it's time to grow and develop somebody else, to give them some visibility, to let them get the fair rewards and the payoffs for their work, step aside. Step aside. We like to think about inclusion as pull up a seat as if the table is ever expanding. But the reality that, you know, Rebecca and Allison point out in their work and that Stephanie, you call attention to, you know, there are power dynamics around leadership. There are promotion processes. At a certain point, there are more opportunities at the lower levels of the organization, but fewer at the more senior levels of the organization. So when you're talking about board diversity in your work, Stephanie, you know, at some point, Alexis Ohanian said, look, this is important enough to me. I'm going to give up my board seat at Reddit so that a woman of color can have this board seat. And then the last is step in front. Like, expect that there's going to be some pushback. This is where allies are most important because you can come in and interface with the most vulnerable people in the organization and those who seek to maintain the status quo and undermine diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives.
Absolutely. Rebecca and Allison, your book isn't specifically about allyship, but I read it and I think it's very highly relevant to this concept of allyship. So Rebecca, I'm not sure if you would like to care to comment a bit more on the implications of the strategies that you lay out. For senior managers, senior leaders, middle managers, or individual contributors, what do you think we should take away as we relate your book to this broader conversation on allyship?
Yeah, I mean, certainly everyone has a role to play when it comes to inclusion. And that's part of the message in our book. And we talk about how to play that role. And we also believe that everyone needs allies, but of course, especially people who've been minimalized or marginalized. And, you know, being an ally does take focus, as Laura spoke about. It also takes skill, you know, maybe practice with our 10 inclusion enablers. It takes courage to gain insight about others and to do that, stepping up and so forth, to grow empathy with others. And to take action alongside or stand up for others. And I think it also takes effort to understand, you know, your own privilege, your own power, and how to use those to include others. And, you know, I think one thing that we're concerned with is that we do sometimes see these sort of cursory ally programs. But what we're advocating for is coherent systems of inclusion and allyship that are anchored in company values and supported by inclusive structures. And that can help make sure that allyship is genuine and that it involves being willing to do things like make space and to listen and to give up power versus a kind of sort of optical allyship, which is more focused on being seen to be an ally and getting some kind of credit for that. So sponsoring, intervening when necessary, looking out for the kinds of opportunities that can benefit others, those are all part of allyship. And more than the individual action and behaviors, I think people in a position of power really need to institute the kind of systemic changes that we write about in the book, you know, building coalitions and creating more cohesive environments that can support the long-term change.
Allison, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think you've covered it all. I've been you know, thinking a lot about allyship in, and particularly in relation to race in you know, this year, and you know, I love the, you know, step up, step aside, and step in front. I think that's a really good sort of you know, prompt way to think about it. And I also love the work of Leila Saad in her book Me and White Supremacy, which where she is very, there's just one thing, so I said I wouldn't add anything, but I would like to add one thing, which I think is the which I think I found very encouraging in her work, where she says that you know, being called out, or indeed being called in, which is probably preferable, is part of the work of anti-racism. So, you know, if it doesn't happen to you at some point or other, then you're probably not doing the work of anti-racism. And I thought that I took that to heart.
Excellent. So I wanted to take some questions from the audience. There's a question here, which is, we've talked a lot about middle managers and how they drive change. Let's talk about individual contributors. So I get this one a lot, and sometimes it comes from a place for my students of feeling like they don't have the power or the authority to make systemic or structural changes. So they're interested in, oftentimes, in knowing, what can I do as just a person who works with other people? And so I'm going to read that into this question around, what are some effective strategies that you see for individual contributors as they're thinking about their organization's DEI goals at a company? Any common pitfalls? And again, I would just throw, let's think about individual contributors who don't have a lot of hierarchical authority. So Allison, I'm going to give that to you, if I may.
Sure, I'll get started on it. And it's actually something that we've had quite a lot of comments about in relation to our book, that people who read it as individual contributors feel that there is a lot in there that they can do, that they can sort of take away and actually start doing, and that it's empowering in that sense, because as we've said several times, you know, everybody has an impact, whether you take action or whether you choose to stand on the sidelines. You have an impact. And so it is critical that you get started, and it could be really, you know, what seem like very small things, but it could be just something as simple as saying, looking at your sort of your trusted network or the people that you go to get feedback on a project or some work or whatever, and actually just thinking about who's in that trusted network and that trusted group of advisors or the people that you usually consult with. And saying, you know, is there somebody different that I could bring into this group? Who could I bring in? Whose perspective am I not getting here? And it's just sort of flipping it around and, you know, reframing it and thinking about how could I do things differently? In your team, it could be about something like, thinking about how do we all work best together? You know, how are we at our most productive? Everybody is different. Let's have a conversation within our team about, all our different working preferences. And this is, you know, this is very live right now, isn't it? With distributed working, with the shift to probably the permanent shift to much more distributed modes of working, and people working at different times of the day and across the world. So actually having a conversation like that, just opening that up, if you haven't had that conversation in your team already, you know, there are things like that that you can do. And then if it turns out to be effective, actually taking that to your team leader, maybe to your supervisor or to somebody else in the organization, saying, look, we did this and we actually noticed that it actually helped our performance. It helped motivation in the team. We did a little bit of measurement on it. Can we roll this out somewhere else in the organization? So that's a start. I'm sure that the others would like to contribute as well.
So I'm going to turn to Laura because Laura is an organizational psychologist by training, which means she always reminds me and us that you as an individual do have more power and control and agency than you think. And so as Laura and I have had conversations recently, we've talked a lot about let's center the person who might be feeling marginalized or otherwise not being supported. How do I help myself? What are some strategies Laura, there's so much of your work that's focused on this, but if you could share some of that with us, I think that would be helpful as well.
Yeah, you know, one of the themes in our research that also came out of the book is around the power of positive identity development and what it means for us to be able to affirm ourselves and our ability to grow, to develop, to be authentic, to make mistakes and forgive ourselves for not being perfect, to shake off the burden of exceptionalism, which is so often placed on the shoulders of Black people and other people who have been marginalized, just feeling like there's no grace, you know, there's no room for error, there's no room for mistake. You know, when we do that, we confine ourselves to remain stuck and closed off and guarded, you know, rather than allowing ourselves to continue to push through and grow and explore. So, you know, the first piece intrapsychically is about cultivating the positive identity. It's having those messages like, I have the right to make a mistake, just like my mediocre white male coworker has a right to make a mistake. They get to show up to work the next day. It's not going to be career ending, you know, and just regardless of what, you know, the atmosphere is sending, just to continue to affirm yourself on that so you can remain on that learning pathway that is so needed. And then the second piece is returning to our earlier conversation about the relationships, about building the relationships. Now, you know, when individual contributors are wondering, oh, wow, what role do I have to play in this? Well, I'll tell you one thing. If you're committing a lot of microaggressions on a day-to-day basis, if you're making jokes, snide remarks, slights, negative comments about different people's social identities, you have a lot of power in that organization. You have the power to create a workplace experience that could be a living hell for somebody who doesn't look like you or feels like they're on the margins. That's a lot of power. So on the flip side, there's a lot of power in affirming relationships as well. And knowing that you have a peer who has your back is good as gold. So I advise people, look for the green lights.
Yes.
Look for the green lights. There's somebody there who's going to send you a signal that they see your strength. They see your value. They are willing to partner with you. There's somebody senior who you're going to run into who shows a special interest in you, who stops and listens a little bit longer when they say, you know, what are you working on today? Or who pulls you aside to give you just a small note of feedback, like, ah, great presentation today. And you're like, oh, wow, follow up with that person. But those are the breadcrumbs, you know, that will lead you to the next level. They're the green lights that help you to travel the road, which can be confusing and obstructed. But those two things really do go hand in hand. Because if in my mind I say, nobody's here to support me, I'm not good enough to be here, I don't deserve to be here, I'm not worthy, then people could be extending themselves to me and I could totally miss it. So I've got to, you know, have that hand in hand. And then we're blessed to have friends who can become colleagues, who can give us real talk. I can call and Stephanie can say, yeah, Laura, you really messed that one up, but that's all right. Then we can laugh about it until we cry and figure out how to troubleshoot so that the next go round, it goes a little bit better.
Yeah. I can't remember when you talked about this green light thing, but I know it was probably sometime in the last 6 months, something positive happened. And I texted you and you were like, green light, and it reminded me that that person was a green light. And I'm like, I know exactly what that means. And I'm hoping that will help more people. I think it's so easy to get down because, you know, it's hard, right? It's hard. Workplaces can be tough and we can concentrate so quickly on the people who are making our days really tough. And so we lose sight of the green lights. And those are the people who we should just like hold on to, you know, follow around and keep going back to, I think is really important. I think I don't know if it was Rebecca or Allison. I wasn't sure. Rebecca, you wanted to get into the conversation.
Yeah, I that was a really compelling and inspiring response, Laura. So really appreciate that. And I did want to just add a couple of nuances to both of the responses to this question. One thing is that, you know, we've seen often and still continue to see in this field that there sometimes is a debate about whether we should focus on individuals and their beliefs and behaviors or changing the system and its processes. And it's actually both. And in the model that we present in our book, we show that those are both part of the same thing. It's not either or, but they actually impact each other. So I just wanted to make that point. And then to make another point that, you know, I think we all know we can take individual action. And we do speak to, I think, about 50 individual actions that people can take in our book. But we also know that we can tell people that they're not alone. Building on Laura's point, you know, each individual can take action, but not be alone. And one of the ways we've seen this kind of coming to life with our book is that people are reading the book as individuals, but then getting together in small groups of reading for action circles so that they can support each other and find ways that they can take action, individual action, but also collectively, and then start to tap into their collective superpower to help drive inclusion.
Absolutely. So we are coming down to our last few minutes, and so we'll probably do like a little bit of a speed round. I'll combine two questions that we have. So students inspire me every day. When I arrived to Wharton 3 years ago, there were not that many students who were saying, oh, I want to take a DEI role in organizations after I graduate. That's not typically why people had decided to apply to Wharton. And today it's so many students either want that as their full-time job or their second, you know, full-time job in addition to their other full-time job. And so my students are really inspired and eager to be change agents, as you can tell from the line of questions today. There obviously are some anxiety around what can I do if I'm not the boss, right? Wondering what advice you have for them. So that's part one of my question. And the other part is coming back to your book specifically. If you were given the opportunity, maybe you are, I don't know, to update it, to include anything from 2020 and beyond in it, what would that be? So first part, advice to these students who are very eager and engaged to jump into organizations. And second, any updates to your book? All right, Allison, can I start with you?
Sure, yes, that's a wonderful question. And I agree that it's inspiring working with students. I would really say that, you know, just to remember and to reinforce the things that have been said in the last round of questions, that, you know, leadership can come from anywhere in an organization. It isn't just about formal titles. And if you're going to be a leader at some point in your life, why not get started now? So I would say use whatever power and influence that you have to advance inclusion. Call on as many different people, as many, you know, different perspectives, as many different experiences as you can. And together, co-create. You can co-create organizations. You can co-create societies that leave no one out. And don't feel that you have to follow the rules. You can help to change the rules. Yeah. So, Rebecca, would you add something to that?
Sure. You know, my advice is partly to embrace the social justice imperative that has really been illuminated, and not only to drive inclusion in organizations by making it indivisible from the mission and the goals of the business, but also to use inclusive strategies and processes to help business and society innovatively address the massive opportunities and challenges ahead. You know, things like climate change as one of the biggest facing humanity right now. You know, with indivisible inclusion, we really can tap into the collective superpower we need so that we can address the social and the economic and the environmental sustainability that we need, and we can do better together.
All right. Allison and Rebecca, updates to your book. Are you thinking about them? Is there anything that you would do differently? Not differently in terms of veering off in a different direction, but would you add a chapter or a paragraph to account for 2020 if asked?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think it's more about adding to and reinforcing the messages in the book, because there have been so many lessons from this crisis, well, from the COVID crisis, from the other crisis we've seen this experience this year, that have really reinforced the importance. So I think one of the things is, you know, the importance of inclusive leadership and systems, because they are actually more effective. We've seen, you know, plenty of examples on the world stage of both caring and careless leadership. And we've seen how that literally makes a difference in terms of life and death. I think that, you know, we are seeing this enormous change in the way that we work, and how important it is to have inclusive skills in the workforce, in teams, in managers, in leaders, in order to enable that. I mean, it's always been true, but it's even truer now. And I think another aspect is that the spotlight that the crisis has put on, which we talk about in the book, but we talk about how organizations really need to take account of all those external stakeholders who include on-demand workers, for example, the contingent workforce, as it's often called. And we've seen the critical role that, you know, that key workers play in society, and how often they come from marginalized populations, how often they are, you know, on low pay, in precarious jobs. What are organizations doing to address inclusion of those people who are essential to them, who actually help the smooth running of their organizations? If you're not doing that, how can you call yourself an inclusive organization?
Some tips or some inspiration for students, and I don't know, what else can you say in race, work, and leadership that is not, again, so there might be something, so take it away for us.
Well, building on Rebecca and Allison, when I think about sort of where we are now versus where we were when, like 18 months ago, really, when we sent this manuscript to press, one of our key recommendations was quite simple. Start talking about race. Start talking about race at work. You know, there was this trifecta of taboo topics at work: race, politics, religion. Kind of hard hard to keep any of those off the table now that we're in 2020. So much has happened, and the boundaries that and compartments that we thought we had that allowed us to pretend as though we were tucking these different experiences away, you know, put it in our back pocket, walk into the front office doors. Well, guess what? You know, I don't know about you all, but I'm sitting here in my home, you know, having this conversation with you all today. So the boundaries that were there before are literally not there, but they've also in our practice and in our action, you know, we have started to embrace inclusion in different ways. We are talking about race. That's simplistic, but still important because it's a first step. And then it does become more sophisticated. And I would offer even more about how to interface with the entire ecosystem in ways that Rebecca and Allison laid out. I mean, we really focus on trying to center and amplify the Black experience of work and what the path is to leadership and what the barriers and obstructions are to that. But to, you know, broaden the aperture and talk about that ecosystem in even more detail, I think would be valuable. There's another aspect of sophistication that's important, and I think is going to carry us into 2021, is the justice conversation. And by justice here, I'm speaking of not just criminal justice in our society more broadly, but I'm talking about organizational justice. I'm talking about holding people accountable for the way that they treat others, for engaging in inclusive practices, for making good on their promises and their statements in that respect. Last thing, students, what do? Bite off one piece that's massive, right? So find your corner of the universe, leverage your strengths, and chip away at it.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sad to say it's time for us to end this fantastic discussion. I have to tell you, you three have energized me and make me feel like I can do a lot of things after we hang up. But I want to thank you so much for your fabulous scholarship, your books, all the work that went into giving us these insights that we can use in our everyday lives. I hope you found this conversation as fascinating as I have. And to all of you who've been listening in, thank you for joining us. Look forward to hearing your thoughts. Take care. Have a good day. Bye now.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.